Good morning and welcome to a brand new episode of Riddles in the Dark, brought to you by the Mythgard Institute. I'm your co-host Dave Kale, and I'm super excited to introduce you to an episode where we will be talking about the centerpiece of all the Hobbit films, of course. No, not dwarves, elves. That's what Empire Magazine and the various news journals and venues said the second film was about. It was all about elves. And of course, given the amount of screen time that Legolas had, that seemed to be the case. We all thought that these movies were about dwarves, but no, in fact, they're about Legolas and the elves. So today we're going to be talking about elves, and more elves, and especially everyone's favorite pretty boy, beautiful brow elf, Thranduil. And so let's stop screwing around and end this painfully long introduction. I'm Dave Kale, as I said, and with me as always are two of the most insightful, most enjoyable and enthusiastic in the morning Tolkien podcasters on the internet, the Tolkien Professor, Corey Olson, and Trish Lambert.
I'm just standing outside Corey's spotlight. I'm just on the edge of the umbra there.
Right, as David Mosley adds, with the best listeners too, of course.
Absolutely.
Welcome.
Yeah, I guess so, some other people too.
So I want to just start off giving a little bit of background again, it's one of the things that has always been the primary focus of our Riddles in the Dark discussions, is really sort of looking at the challenges for adaptation in the books, and really trying to review what the book actually says, and not only the published Hobbit, but the rest of Tolkien's writings as well, to give a kind of grounding of what the Peter Jackson team has to work with, and the kind of, as I say, challenges that confront them. So I wanted to begin with that, especially since in the Mythgard Academy class, the open class that I've been teaching now for the last couple months, we've been going through Unfinished Tales, and we're in the middle of the Third Age section of Unfinished Tales right now. And just in the last couple weeks, last week, I was looking at the discussion of Thranduil, one of the only places, in fact, the only place that I recall, that Tolkien goes back and tells us some of Thranduil's backstory, tells us some of the things that
Galadriel.
It's actually, yes. It's at the very end. It's in one of the appendices of the Galadriel chapter, at the end of part two of Unfinished Tales.
He got into an appendix.
He got into like the butt end of an appendix in a chapter on Galadriel. So there you go.
Like an afterthought.
Exactly. But anyway,
can I just say, sure. That session on Galadriel, your Galadriel meta history session, I think. Actually, I would say this of several of the Unfinished Tales classes that you've done over the last few weeks have been some of my favorite Corey Olson podcasts in like a long time, maybe forever.
The
Aldarion and Arrendis thing. I actually listened to that one multiple times just because I just thought it was so good. And then the Galadriel meta history stuff was just fantastic. You're really killing it recently, man.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thank you. It's been a lot. That class has been so much fun. I've been I kind of thought when the Council of the Wise and the Democratic voters selected Unfinished Tales, I kind of thought it sounded like a good idea, but it has been like way more fun even than I thought. And I have I've learned so much as I usually do when I go through and teach this stuff. I've never really looked at Unfinished Tales as carefully as I'm doing now, and
killing it, Trish?
Oh, absolutely. Well, he actually even killed my thesis.
I was going to say. Trish, I think, has mixed feelings about this.
No, it's okay. I can let everybody know my thesis, and Corey and I had talked about this, was to like look at the evolution of Galadriel through the years as he was, as his own life proceeded and his daughter grew up and, the women in his professional life, that he mentored and whatnot, and the publishing house and whatnot, and what impact that might have. I'm listening to the Unfinished Tales thing, I guess Corey hadn't really thought of it either. I mean, he's sitting there and Corey goes, well, actually, he really only wrote the Galadriel story after he'd written Lord of the Rings, and I went, oh, well, okay, that blows that piece
of idea. Yeah.
Oh, so you were thinking, oh, here we go off on a long long detour, but still, you were thinking that he, you were, but you still have, like, you still have what's the word that Gandalf uses in the Council of Elrond to describe a long period of time? Like, it's like a wide, crap, I can't remember, but you still have a nice wide window of time over which Galadriel evolves following Lord of the Rings, don't you?
It's true, only the thing I was going to do was sort of, like, look to see, was there any impact, say, for example, Priscilla as a child with all the brothers that she had, and the way he described, you know, and, yeah, he may have had, like, vague recollections of that in the 1950s, but I told Corey, I said it would be too much critfic. I would have to do too much critfic to make that, to try to make a connection, and it just scholastically and academically I couldn't bring myself to do that. And I mean, Corey did come up with some other suggestions, you know, but I'm like, no, you know, I just don't have the fire for that. And to do this kind of a thing, you got to really keep your, you know, you got to have the passion for it. So I do have another topic which I will keep.
Why don't you just dig really, really deep and draw some really, really tenuous conclusions? Look at some of the female elf characters that he writes pre-Lord of the Rings, and like draw some really, really weak inferences.
Well, the weak inferences part wasn't, but that was kind of what Corey was suggesting.
It is possible, you know, because you could easily go to, you know, draw some kind of continuity between Luthien and Melian in the early stages,
right.
You know, then right. And sort of Galadriel as right. the inheritor of that thread in more than one way.
Well, and there
you
are
know,
themes.
It's possible.
You know, I think I mentioned to you, Corey, at one point, there's the theme of restlessness, which is like mm-hmm. Arathel mm-hmm. and Galadriel. You know,
yes.
I mean, there's like some characteristics that could share. But anyway,
so yeah.
I mean, we're kind of talking about elves, but not really elves with regards to
the tour, right, so. Right. However,
I mean,
yes.
I could do the Trish show forever, but I don't think that's
what I'm going to do. Yeah, well, so, Thranduil, as I said, I'd like to start, before we get to some of the Unfinished Tales stuff, because I was in that, I didn't cover Thranduil in the Galadriel class. I went back to it in my bonus session last week. But when I was covering that, I was making a bunch of very thinly veiled references to the films, but I wanted to save it for today, because I knew we were going to be talking about this soon.
Yeah, so, very thinly veiled.
So I want to come back to those. Yes, Kate, exactly. I want to talk about the facial scars. So, but first we need to remember where this all comes from, and that is to say from the published Hobbit. And there's a wide space of there's a wide gap in time. I want to talk about the backstory of Thranduil that we get in Unfinished Tales, but you know, there's several decades between that and the published Hobbit. So, going back to the published Hobbit, it's important for us to remember that the wood elves in the Hobbit, you know, in some ways don't exactly fit in the schema. What we naturally want to do, and, you know, we've already talked about this some on this podcast, the way in which, you know, Peter Jackson did what surprised me and invoked the whole Sindar-Sylvan class divide within Mirkwood and everything, and that's all there in Tolkien, and it's led us at various points to talk about the differences between the Sindar and the Sylvan elves and that reference. By Toriel has kind of brought the genealogical division of the elves kind of back into a good deal of discussion recently, and that's great, but to some extent, that's not the primary text. I mean, of course it's relevant, it's in the background, but in the published Hobbit, it's still in the background. And what we get of the wood elves, on the one hand, Tolkien explicitly connects the wood elves in Mirkwood to the basic elven structure of his mythology, you know, of his legendarium, in that famous passage, that famous paragraph in chapter 8 of The Hobbit, which describes, you know, the three different kindreds of the elves, the light elves and the deep elves and the sea elves, and that the wood elves were related, you know, were those that did not go to faerie in the West. And, you know, anybody who knows the Silmarillion stuff, which, remember, was nobody, almost nobody on Earth, like five people or fewer at the time that the Hobbit was published. But anyway, for those of us who do know the Silmarillion, we all recognize that. But I urge great caution here, as I do in all of the Silmarillion references in The Hobbit. I think the evidence in the text of The Hobbit is that he's not connecting this explicitly with the Legendarium. Rather, he is recycling ideas from the Legendarium and incorporating them into The Hobbit. This is why we get, you know, this sort of pseudo-Silmaril at the end in the Arkenstone. And why the question that I get asked so often, is the Arkenstone a Silmaril, is so bloody complicated to answer, because you know, the answer is yes and no. I guess I just give an elven answer, right? I will say both no and yes. So the Wood Elves and their history, in part, is something that he's incorporating from the Silmarillion, that he's recycling from the Silmarillion tradition. Also, if you pay close attention to the description of the bad blood that exists between the Wood Elves and the Dwarves, it sounds like, again, it's, you know, people who know the Silmarillion will recognize references to the fall of Doriath and the, you know, the misunderstanding between Thingol and the dwarves of Nogrod. But that is also, again, if you actually pay attention closely to the details of what is described in The Hobbit, it's not the same. It doesn't actually, it's not precisely the same story, even of what was in Tolkien's writings at that time. Not only is it different from the published Silmarillion, which we would expect, but it's different from the story as he had just written it the year before he wrote The Hobbit. So again, it's not simply that he's connecting it to those same stories. So my point is, the Wood Elves in the published Hobbit, it's not enough just for us to go back to the Silmarillion. It's not enough just to go back to that material and say, okay, let's remind ourselves about the elves in the Silmarillion, and this is what Tolkien is putting into the Hobbit. It's not exactly what he's putting into the Hobbit. Because, in fact, mingled with those recycled ideas from his Legendarium, from the Silmarillion material, mixed in with those are more just sort of folktale references, you know, things which are associated, you know, concepts and motifs that are associated with fairies and with fairy in, you know, in many traditional stories, in many traditional fairy tales. And so that's you know, like I'm thinking here of, for instance, the whole experience at the bridge, or at the non-bridge, at the river that they have to cross, and the whole it appears to be elven enchantment that Bomber falls under when he goes into the river. But so, I mean, that sequence, that there is a magic river that has to be crossed, but there's a taboo on it. You can't, not only can you not drink it, you can't touch it, or you'll fall under an enchantment. And the enchantment that you fall under is an enchanted sleep. And in your enchanted sleep, you seem to be brought into contact with the elves. It's like being taken by the elves, as happens very frequently in the fairy tale tradition, that someone is sort of abducted or captured by the elves. Bomber isn't physically captured, but he is put into this sleep, and in his sleep, he has all these dreams about the elves, dreams which in fact turn out to be true, that to be directly predictive of the elves that they're about to meet. So in some
Bomber
sense,
the prophet.
Yes, he is technically, according to the terms of medieval definitions, he is having a visio of the elves. That is a prophetic dream which comes true right away as soon as you wake up. It's not instantly in Bomber's case, but I'd still call it a visio anyway. Sorry, I've been teaching my Chaucer dream vision classes, so we've been talking a lot about dream vision categories. So sorry, I have Macrobius and his commentary on the dream of Scipio on my mind. Some of those things. I mean, the enchanted river and the enchanted sleep that Bomber falls into, I would point to as one of the elements which is most alien to elves as they're depicted everywhere else in Tolkien's Legendarium, but quite familiar to people who read fairy tales or traditional fairy stories. Another element, which I would also put up there, is the whole fairy circle thing, the circle of fairy feasters, which, when a mortal stumbles into it, suddenly vanish, and possibly abduct the person who burst into their midst. That is a very old idea about fairies, that you can find fairy rings in the forest, and you might, as a mortal, come upon the edge of a clearing and find mortals dancing in a ring, as Smith does in Smith of Wootton Major, or you might you might find them, you know, celebrating and feasting like this. But if you just blunder in without an invitation, then At the least, they're going to vanish. At the worst, they're going to take you with them. And good things might not happen to you. Good things might happen to you, but probably not. As, of course, happens to Thorin in the book. So again, you know, in many ways, the Wood Elves, as Tolkien depicted them in The Hobbit, don't really fit into the concept of elves as we have come to know them through The Lord of the Rings, primarily, and through The Silmarillion, secondarily. And I would ask you to remember as well that in his initial drafts of The Hobbit, this was changed before the first edition, but in his when he wrote out The Hobbit in its first draft, he used the word fairy not quite frequently, but he did use it quite a lot, and he used it interchangeably with the word elf. That's very much how Tolkien was thinking about them.
Can I actually make a point here that sure. Faye actually brought this up in the questions, and I realize there may be others that this. I think it's important for us to remember, and it took me a while. Actually, Corey was the one kind of introduced this to me. The Silmarillion, as it's published, is not the way Tolkien wrote it. What I mean by that is he kind of wrote the Silmarillion in pieces throughout his entire lifetime.
Yes.
And the book that's published is what Christopher, his son, chose from his larger, huge number of papers to publish, right?
Yeah, so, well, it was tricky because basically there were sort of two different impulses that Tolkien had. One was to write a kind of a chronicle, to write it basically in the form that the published Silmarillion is in, you know, the kind of overview of the history. But that's not the only model that he used. One of the primary ones was, Trish, as you say, just him writing a bunch of different stories. It started off as a collection of stories within a frame in the Book of Lost Tales. Then he took some of those stories and really dug into them, and so started to develop them and write full length versions of them in poetic form in the alliterative Children of Húrin and in the rhyming couplet Lay of Lathian, the Beren and Lúthien story. And he wanted he seemed to have plans to do others in this way. He did go back. Faye, the text I'm primarily talking about when I'm talking about sort of being contemporary with The Hobbit, the Book of Lost Tales were written in the teens, leading up to about 1920. Then in the 20s was when he was spending most of his time writing poetry primarily. Most of these things didn't get put into prose during the 20s. But right at the end, he did what he called a sketch of the mythology. He wanted to give an overview to somebody, and then he kind of expanded that overview into what he called the Quenta Silmarillion, and that was the first Silmarillion model historical overview of the entire mythology, and that was written in 1930. So that first overview that he did, incorporating a lot of the stuff, but altering a lot of the things from the unfinished or the Book of Lost Tales period. That's the stuff. If you want to see like where the Silmarillion stood in Tolkien's mind at the time of The Hobbit, look in volume 4 of the History of Middle-earth series. It's called The Shaping of Middle-earth. That's where you can find the sketch of the mythology and what's called the 1930 Quenta. It's the Quenta Silmarillion he wrote in 1930. That's the same year he wrote The Hobbit. So that is like what is exactly contemporaneous with The Hobbit. Is as far as he was quite possibly working on the two of them together, or even possibly writing some of that Quenta material after he'd written The Hobbit. So you can see exactly where the state of his thoughts were. So basically, just to kind of finish the Silmarillion story, at the end, he went back and revised a lot of this stuff. When Christopher went to publish it, he had a couple of choices. All of this material he could have tried to put out in a couple different ways. In the end, he decided to do the Quenta model to produce that sort of Quenta Silmarillion overview, which Tolkien had come back and revised again later on.
I think the way I tend to think of it generally myself is The Hobbit had a definite beginning, middle, and an end in terms of the writing process.
Yes.
The Silmarillion, not so much.
right. Yeah. No, exactly. It's quite a long and tortuous process of just basically of Tolkien developing his own ideas and really sort of trying different, totally different literary models. And essentially this was him embodying these stories that he loved and thought about and worked on throughout his life, you know, just in different ways at different times. And anyway, so that's sort of that material. But again, the point is that you can't just equate the Silmarillion stuff with The Hobbit. Now, when he goes back, he's got to recontextualize things. And the Wood Elves are one of those people, you know, one of those areas in The Hobbit that need most recontextualization. Some things in The Hobbit that don't quite fit can just be dropped or downplayed, as, for instance, the stone giants who disappear completely, or almost completely, and the trolls who don't disappear but get shoved aside. Like, don't expect, you know, we get that wonderful passage that I love so much at the beginning of the, I think it's at the beginning of chapter 2, of The Hobbit, of The Fellowship of the Ring, where we get that passage that basically says, don't expect trolls to be, you know, like cockney and comical now, if you meet them now. You know, so trolls are no longer dull-witted, you know, but now they are like cruel and terrible and awful. So, you know, some of those things which no longer really fit into the world as he's envisioning it by the Lord of the Rings, he could get rid of. The elves, of course, obviously he could not. And in writing The Lord of the Rings, he has by that time now made the firm decision, which does not seem to have been made when he was writing The Hobbit, that he's going to include this story. This story is going to be part of the Legendarium. It's going to be connected, actually historically connected with the Silmarillion material. Therefore, he's got to change the Wood Elves. He needs to fit the Wood Elves retroactively into his schema. So what he does is he says that the Wood Elves are Sylvan Elves. This he already had, right? He already had connected them this way in that recycled bit from the Silmarillion that I mentioned before, that they are some of those elves that never went to Faerie in the West, who never crossed to Valinor, to use the Silmarillion vocabulary. Now, the Wood Elves in particular, you know, there's dark elves, and then there's dark elves. You know, you've got the Sindar, who went over into Beleriand and fought with the Noldor and against Morgoth, and you've got, you know, the people of Thingol in Doriath. They are the gray elves. They are the Sindar. The Sylvan Elves, the Elves of Mirkwood, almost all of the Elves of Mirkwood, are elves that never even went to Beleriand. They don't even figure in the plot of the Silmarillion at all. They take no part in any of the actions and, by and large, know nothing about anything that occurred in the First Age in the Silmarillion, because they were hanging out exactly where they still are in the Lord of the Rings. They were hanging out in Greenwood. The elves came from the east and traveled to the west. Some of them got as far as that and decided not to cross the Misty Mountains, and so to stay there in Rovanion, to stay there on the, you know, on the east side of the Misty Mountains. And when everybody came back from Beleriand after the end of the First Age, you know, when Galadriel crosses over and the Numenoreans return, there are these elves still there, having been living peacefully in the Greenwood for millennia. That's who the Sylvan Elves are, but that's not who Thranduil is. Thranduil is one of the Sindar who comes back, presumably from Beleriand. So he and his dad, Thranduil was not the king of Mirkwood all the way through. Anyway, there are several examples of Noldor or Sindar coming back from Beleriand, going in amongst the Sylvan Elves, and being sort of accepted among them. That's what happens with Thranduil and his father and with his son, Legolas, and that's what happens with Celeborn. And Galadriel, of course, is a Noldor and not a Sindar, but that's how we get to where we are. Now, when Tolkien is explaining sort of the backstory of Thranduil, you know, where he has been, and where he sort of what his outlook is. Thranduil became king when his father was killed at the Battle of the Last Alliance. Thranduil was personally at the Battle of Dagorlad, we are told. But not only was he at the Battle of Dagorlad, it was a really bad experience for him. He very much didn't enjoy himself. We're told that the elves of Mirkwood went to the Battle of the Last Alliance. They answered the call of Gil-galad. See, I'm pulling up my PowerPoint here, which has my... So I might as well look at some of these Thranduil passage that we're talking about here. The elves of Mirkwood answer the call of Gil-galad, but they went ill-equipped. They didn't have much armor. They were not battle disciplined. You know, they were just wild elves, and they got slaughtered in the Battle of Dagorlad. Thranduil survived and went home, but he went home with a small remnant of the people that he brought. And he was scarred by the experience, we were told. This is the one passage I talked about in class. There was in Thranduil's heart a still deeper shadow. He had seen the horror of Mordor and could not forget it. If ever he looked south, its memory dimmed the light of the sun, and though he knew that it was now broken and deserted and under the vigilance of the kings of men, fear spoke in his heart that it was not conquered forever. It would arise again. Basically, you know, when I was looking at this passage, when I reread that passage again in preparation for this class, I'm sitting there, I'm like, I think there is about a 2% chance that this passage was not in Philippa Boyens' head when they were planning Thranduil in The Desolation of Smaug.
That seems too high.
That seems too high, yeah. Well, I think so. I mean, it is clear. I mean, that scene, the scene with the, you know, the captive orc that gets interrogated and then decapitated dishonorably, shows that he is, you know, he's already shown his physical scars to Thorin or whatever that is. He is manifestly showing his psychological scars in that scene, that he is obviously terrified, horrified at the arising again of Sauron. Now, the only other interpretation of that passage that even makes a small bit of sense, not that I am hoping for this or think that this is likely, but the only other explanation I can think of for Thranduil's behavior in that scene is if they're going to actually depict him as corrupted, you know, if he's going to be like a secret ally of Sauron's or something and is trying to shut the orc up. I think that's deeply unlikely, but it's literally the only other explanation I can think of for why they would have him act that way. But this concept of him as this would explain why he's an isolationist, why he believes in just sticking within their borders, because he you know, he remembers what happened the last time he went out of his borders, the last time he marched his, you know, here's Toriel, easy for her to say, hey, let's head up and go fight the spiders, let's trace them to their source, let's take the battle to the enemy. And there's Thranduil saying, dude, you have no idea what it was like when we took the battle to the enemy last time. I remember, and I am not going there again. That to me, it may be this is not what's in their heads. It may be that this is not, in fact, how things work out in film 3. But thinking of film 2 alone, this paragraph made more sense to me of the depiction of Thranduil in The Desolation of Smaug than any other that I have seen or heard about. And to me, because Thranduil is a jerk. You know, one other thing about that moment in The Desolation of Smaug, Alyssa House-Thomas sent me a really good email about this in the context of last week's discussion when we were talking about violence, is that, you know, she was saying that that moment when Thranduil decapitates the captive orc is one of the most difficult to sort of reconcile with Tolkien's world that she had had, and I agree with her. Thranduil's casual decapitation of a prisoner, and a prisoner, what's more, whom he has promised to release, breaking his word and decapitating the prisoner, that is something that good people, capital G, capital P, as the Wood Elves are supposed to be, do not do in Tolkien's world. That is a violation of the sort of deeper code of Tolkien's world, which is more profound than almost anything else that we see in the film. I agree with that.
Hey, he kept the letter of his word.
but Dave, do you remember who else did that?
Sauron.
Yes, yeah. Sauron to Gorlim the Hapless. Exactly.
Right.
Tell me what I want and I will release you. And he kills him instead. And how chilling is that parallel, right?
You can see your wife too. Again. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, maybe. And honestly, that...
Do you think the goblins now refer to that poor goblin as the unhappy?
Yeah, exactly. Poor what's-his-name, the unhappy. Yeah, exactly. yeah. But yes, I mean... That parallel, I mean, you know, you could push that parallel and say, hey, maybe like he is going over to the dark side. You know, maybe that parallel is supposed to be evidence that he is, in fact, turning and becoming evil. And we can sort of think about that a little bit more going forward, I think, when we look at what Thranduil and the elves are going to be doing in film 3. But anyway, I just think this is important. Thinking about the physical scars for a second, as I said, have said before, and I can't remember exactly when it was, you know, we don't really know much about the backstory. The other element, and it's there in The Hobbit, Thranduil claims to have knowledge of dragons, you know, that he is a wise elf, and so he knows that Thorin is not really likely to kill the dragon, and he reasons that Thorin is either a fraud or is just planning to steal something, which the narrator commends. The narrator says, and this shows that he's a wise elf, right? Because he does, in fact, know enough about dragons to know that Thorin and company alone have very small chance of actually killing Smaug. So my guess still about the scars, it's possible, of course, maybe he got the scars in the Battle of Dagorlad, but, you know, I think it's possible. And by the way, it's not like there's a 0% chance that there was a dragon or two involved in that battle. There might well have been. It's conceivable. But it may also be a separate thing. If you want to connect Thranduil not only with, you know, sort of his past history in the war, but also if you want to bring Thranduil in to the whole dragon sickness plot, the whole lust for treasure plot, the reference to his desire for those gems suggests that, you know, that he has already kind of declared himself willing to be unscrupulous and to imprison people who should be his allies and to turn away from people who should be his allies for the sake of these gems that he desires and have been kept from him. And we know that's the other fact that we're given about the elves and about Thranduil in particular, about the Elven King in particular in the published Hobbit, which is that he has a love for gems. He has a love for treasure. He wants to get more treasure and to build a bigger hoard. And I think that I would even call him the number two, well, number three, if you count the master, I suppose, but the number two most susceptible to dragon sickness in the Hobbit. The Siege of the Lonely Mountain, the standoff between Thorin and Bard and Thranduil at the gates of the king, well, the wall of the king, really, when Thorin rebuilds it, is, you know, to me, it's sort of all about the dragon sickness. You know, that is sort of the outward manifestation of the spirit of Smaug that we saw that he had and that he was attempting to instill in Bilbo. And Thranduil is one of the guilty parties there. And, you know, he can say, long shall I tarry ere I begin this war for gold. But he sure didn't tarry very long before he set out with his army to go to the mountain. You know, so he's not completely lost to dragon sickness in the book.
But he thought it would be more comfortable to tarry at the foot of the mountain.
Exactly, right. Right, yeah, exactly.
He thought, why tarry in the comfort of my beautiful, gorgeous... elven halls with the forests and the lovely guest suites with the locks on the outside of the doors, when we could be camped in a military encampment in the mire of a barren wasteland. Yeah,
right.
in the desolation of Smaug. Like that,
right.
Oh, it seems much more comfortable.
Absolutely.
He just likes to travel. He likes staying in hotels.
Long shall I tarry in my heavily entrenched defensive positions, investing the mountain ere I begin this war for gold. He's not entirely single-minded there.
Hey, guys, Brent Sprinkle and I have come up with a new term.
Okay.
You know, when you were talking about maybe Thranduil's going over to the dark side,
yes.
Brent said, as Yoda says, fear leads to the dark side. And I said, oh, my gosh, we need to call this crossfic.
The application of terms and themes from one book
to
another. Yes.
That's
from
right.
one word to another.
You know. Actually, though, in the world of Tolkien podcasting, Trish, I think the more appropriate thing to call that is pulling a Father Roderick.
Pulling a Father Roderick,
true.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Well, anyway, so that's I might as well show my other Thranduil one. This is about his isolationism specifically. Now, remember, this is written after The Lord of the Rings, so we're 2 decades after The Hobbit was published. When 1,000 years of the Third Age had passed and the shadow fell upon Greenwood the Great, the Sylvan Elves ruled by Thranduil retreated before it as it spread ever northward, until at last Thranduil established his realm in the northeast of the forest and delved there a fortress and great halls underground. So notice, this means that the halls of the Elven King predate the shadow. That the arise of the shadow in Mirkwood is what caused him to settle there. So we've got some, you know...
Gosh, you could say the elves were in crisis, couldn't you?
You know, that does sound a little bit crisis-like, doesn't it? Anyway... Orifer, that's Thranduil's dad. Orifer was of Sindarin origin, and no doubt Thranduil, his son, was following the example of King Thingol long before in Doriath, though his halls were not to be compared with Menegroth. He had not the arts, nor the wealth, nor the aid of the dwarves, and compared with the elves of Doriath, his sylvan folk were rude and rustic. Orifer had come among them with only a handful of Sindar, and they were soon merged with the Sylvan Elves, adopting their language and taking names of Sylvan form and style. This they did deliberately, for they and other similar adventurers, forgotten in the legends or only briefly named, came from Doriath after its ruin and had no desire to leave Middle-earth, nor to be merged with the other Sindar of Beleriand, dominated by the Noldoran exiles, for whom the folk of Doriath had no great love. They wished indeed to become Sylvan folk and to return, as they said, to the simple life natural to the elves before the invitation of the Valar had disturbed it. So we have not only him retreating before the shadow and digging his defensive but not very sophisticated halls underground in the north of Mirkwood. We also have this general back to the earth movement among the Sylvan, loose Sindar who come among the Sylvan Elves. So this desire to say, you know, basically thinking about the arguments that Toriel makes in the film, you know, the like, this is our fight argument, the, you know, we should take this fight to the enemy thing. She's talking like an elf of Beleriand there. Like, those are the kinds of arguments they used in Beleriand. Like, oh, the enemy is here. We should fight him. We should stand up to him, or at least hold him in leaguer. And the Sylvan Elves, by and large, are saying, you know what? No.
That didn't work so great.
What'd you say?
I said, that didn't work so
That didn't
great.
Work out so great. Exactly.
Do you remember how that went?
Yeah. How's that working out for you guys up there? I don't think so. You know, we don't want any Nirnaeth or Noidiad around here. So we're gonna be fine. We prefer to number our tears. Thank you very much.
Yes. We actually counted those tears.
We counted them, and we want to still be able to at the end of the day. So, you know, again, so this concept of, you know, again, it's something that I think a lot of people have a hard time with, like how Thranduil in the film can appear almost like cartoon villainy, you know, like why is he acting like such a, you know, a snob and such a jerk, and that is his isolationism, you know, the whole, like, why would you not go? Remember, people had a hard time with this in the Two Towers film. You know, like, why would Théoden be like, no, let's not fight. Let us run away instead. And everyone's like, Théoden wouldn't say that. Well, you're right. Théoden wouldn't say that. But Thranduil might actually say that. There's plenty of precedent for elves to basically say it's not our business. You know, I mean, if it doesn't come into our realm, it's not our problem. You know, we are focused on living in this realm and of being at one with this land. And if this land that we have here is not in danger, then, you know, we're not, it's not our problem. And that seems to be, you know, so you combine that with the retreat before the shadow and Thranduil's psychological scars about the shadow rising again and his fear of going out and having to fight the enemy again. That seems to me to give plenty of explanation for why he would take the line that Thranduil in the film did take. So, okay. With that,
you know, I'm feeling good about my property here. For those of you that don't know this, I started with a 23-acre property about a year ago, and I've named it after a Quenya name, meaning the renewer. Anyway, I had a pest control guy come out the other day because it's getting warmer, and I'm concerned about, you know, biota, fauna in particular, you know, getting into places I don't want them to get into. And he comes out and he goes, "You live in the middle of the forest." And I'm like, oh, cool. I'm like a sylvan elf.
Exactly.
Are you fighting the long defeat? Trick?
She is, yes, fighting the long defeat. Yes. The shadow is falling upon Texas, and she is retreating into her little
have to
realm.
That'll be a blog post for my blog. Against pests.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So, okay. So anyway, sorry. I'll get rid of this.
Isn't that funny that... this is like kind of a meta, I don't want to wade too far in these waters, but isn't that funny that people have such a hard time with that, with those kinds of non-interventionist character portrayals? I think that's at least amongst American film viewers and readers, that's there. I think that gets to our core of our fondness for, you know, foreign interventionism and running around the world.
Like, yes,
it is very interesting.
Yeah, the idea that you would just sit around and mind your own business seems like an evil thing to do.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
By the way, that was one of my favorite parts of the Aldarian chapter. I thought that was really interesting.
That
bit at the end where he basically just says, "Well, I have two choices, and they both suck."
Right. Yeah. 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 Exactly.
I think in this case you can make the same argument for Thranduil. I do. You know, I think that the. I think that the part of the reason in the film that our minds rebel against it a little bit is the sense that, like, the fact that he's sitting there saying this, like, look, you know, we can't help the rest of the world. We just got to stay here and defend our own borders. We're not the police of the world. We can't do everything. But it's like, but this isn't about, you know, trying to help some people on the other part of the world. They are literally on your doorstep.
Right. Here. Right.
Like, it seems a little, I'm kind of wondering if perhaps in some extended edition we'll get more details and we'll get a filled out. But it seems that I'm with these films, I'm noticing that we should probably, when we see a scene and we're like, well, that didn't make any sense. I don't understand that character. Yada, yada, yada. There's a very good chance that there's probably something that's been cut that actually puts it into a larger context.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to see what we get.
Yeah.
And I hope it comes back in the extended edition.
Yeah. No, as we continue to hope for our, like, 5.5-hour extended edition of The Desolation of Smaug. thinking forward now to film 3, there are two major things two major moments in the plot. And of course, you know, we can also talk about if there are going to be major elements of the plot that you know, we're not anticipating just based on what happens in the book. But two things which seem inevitable are, first, the interaction between the wood elves and the lake men after the destruction of Lake Town. And then secondly, the standoff, the siege of the, you know, what I'm calling, following John Ratliff from the history of the Hobbit, by the way, what I am calling the Siege of the Lonely Mountain later on. And the partnership between the Elven King and Bard in the book, and their opposition to Thorin and ultimately to the other dwarves as well. And so thinking about those things, you know, there may be other factors, you know, there may be whole other plot movements that we're not anticipating in film 3, but it seems like those two things have to happen. I can't imagine we're not going to get, we know we're going to get the Battle of Five Armies, so I can't imagine, we're, you know, we know that the elves and the humans are going to get there. First of all, do you think there's any chance that we don't get the intervention of the elves with the Lake Men? Like, I mean, theoretically, they could all just arrive separately. And be having some kind of a complicated three-way standoff, or, you know, all arrive separately and they form an alliance there. What do you think? Do you think they're going to meet up at Lake Town? Do you think we're going to get the, you know, the Elven King goes off, but then turns aside to provide, you know, assistance to the refugees of Lake Town before he goes up to the Lonely Mountain? Do you think we're going to get that?
That's an interesting idea. What might they do with that?
In the book, one of the consequences of this is it moderates the sort of profiteering nature of the elves' mission. They're plainly out to get the treasure of Thror that's lying, they now believe, unattended in the Lonely Mountain. But the fact that they're going to turn aside from that to go to help the Lake Men as soon as they discover that that the Lake Men need help, that's a redeeming moment for them. You know, that they are they're obviously good people if they prioritize the lives of these people with whom they don't seem to have any other connection other than the fact that they engage in trade with one another in the book. And I don't see any other evidence than that in the film either. But anyway, so basically there seems to be very small, call. I mean, it's not like the Lake Men are their vassals or something. They don't seem to have, you know, it seems to be pure altruism that leads the elves to stop and help the men of Lake Town. And
maybe in the movie he comes to call Tariel to heal. Come on, get away from that door. Right. Come with me.
Right. I mean, it is true that having brought Toriel and Legolas to Lake Town in film 2, we already have that connection, which provides maybe a tenuous excuse for some elves to go out after. I mean, Legolas went chasing after Toriel. Is somebody going to come chasing after Legolas? You know, it doesn't seem impossible. The elves knew that an orc band in force was heading to Lake Town. Is it possible that when Thranduil discovers that his son and heir has gone off, you know, alone to pursue Toriel towards the place and engage this orc band, that he might come with armed assistance to fight what he thinks is probably an orc band in or around Lake Town? I mean, it seems possible that that could be used as an excuse to get Thranduil and an army towards Lake Town.
I've got another idea. Legolas shows back up at the hall, so the elves go, "Dad, the orc gave me a bloody nose."
Right.
Thranduil goes, "By God, we're going to war."
That's right. This means war.
I think actually specifically what they're going to do is first they're going to stop by Dol Guldur so that Thranduil can talk to Bolg's father.
That's right.
Your son is a bully.
Yes. I can't help but notice that my son received a passing cosmetic injury from one of your people, and I'm going to take that up with you personally because we don't suffer for that kind of thing.
But actually, I mean, I could see a link being made. I mean, here we've already gotten established the fact that Thranduil is materialistic. We've also gotten established the fact, clearly, that the Master is materialistic. And I would think that might end up becoming the basis for an alliance between them. Because the Master is, I'm believing, is going to continue to be a figure beyond where he is in the book in movie 3.
That is one thing that seems almost guaranteed. We'll come back to this in a later episode when we talk about Lake Town politics and stuff. But I agree. In the book, after the master manipulates the rest of the people to be angry at the dwarves and get ready to march on the mountain, he vanishes. And it's just the Bard show from there on out. It's a little hard to believe that that Stephen Fry's master is going to do that.
I don't see him necessarily going to the mountain himself, but I certainly see him like calling the soldiers of Lake Town to go off to the mountain.
Right. Right. Yeah. No, I can easily see that. Right. But again, and he's going to be presumably opposing Bard, you know, so there's probably going to be some complexities there.
Right.
You know, I assume the relationship between Bard and the Master is not going to be completely ended once Bard escapes from prison, which he's presumably going to do. I don't want to get too wrapped up in that. But
right.
just thinking about what the elves' point of view and what they're doing, you know, what they are up to. I think it is a really interesting question. It's an opportunity to show, you know, perhaps they'll do the same thing in the films. Perhaps they will take this as an opportunity to show the elves being kind, the elves being generous. You know, maybe in this way, they are following in the footsteps, essentially, of Toriel, who went to Lake Town out of compassion, and while there, ended up healing somebody. That was all that she did. She barely fought. She instead brought healing. Maybe that becomes sort of a parallel for what Thranduil
will
do.
Oh, you and your rose-colored glasses. I don't think that's what they're
going
to do.
No, well.
I bet you Thranduil goes to Lake Town to verify the news that he's received that the dragon is dead. That would probably be the reason he would go.
Right, he's got to see it with his own eyes. He's not going to believe it until he sees the steaming corpse of Smaug.
Of Smaug. And then he and the Master are going to get into conversation and discover that they have sort of similar interests. And so he decides he's going to use... I mean, he'll never be the peer. You know, he'll never consider the Master his peer, but he would go into
Will it be the Master or will it be Bard?
I think the Master, because the whole deal is going to be, let's go to the mountain and plunge, you know, plunder the wealth in the mountain. I don't think Bard would... That wouldn't be Bard's thing. That would definitely be the Master's thing.
That would be a pretty big change from the book.
It sure would.
The Master is sort of...
We know Jackson doesn't make big changes from the
book. Yeah, well...
Right, yeah, exactly. That pretty much rules that out. However, don't forget, we're not talking about that today. Focus on the elves.
That's right. So, I mean, that would be my thing. I mean, I just can't imagine Thranduil making that huge of a change in character, especially given the fact that he's going to be going back to his greedy self, we assume, later, that I think his reason to go to Lake Town would be more self-serving than a Red Cross visit.
Possibly.
I think that's interesting because they've set it up with Legolas and Tauriel. Like they've laid some groundwork for them suggesting an intervention and for them specifically suggesting that they stop by Lake Town first, because they've already been there. They've seen that the town has been attacked by goblins. Don't forget also last thing that Legolas and Tauriel knew, the dwarves were in Lake Town.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right.
So, a natural thing might be to head out and go directly to Lake Town to see if there's any dwarves hanging around to try and capture them. What in the book, his army, the Elf King's army, marches out because they know Smaug is dead, right?
Yes.
I don't think he needs confirmation. He has he has information. He's got, like, you know, he probably talks
first. Well, no, the book Elven King doesn't need that.
Yeah. So I kind of I guess his motivations could be different now, because now we have Legolas and Tauriel riding back to report, "Hey, there's something really strange going on."
Tauriel might still be in Lake Town too.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, good point.
The other thing about Legolas and Tauriel that we've seen this precedent of them caring, I look at that more as that set up to contrast Thranduil's, personality. That he's the opposite of that. He doesn't want to help. But Legolas and Tauriel, this is the beginning of their kind of getting away from him, you know, that they're looking at things differently than he does.
Yeah, yeah. That's one of the things that I find kind of fascinating about this. You know, it's one thing that's been in my mind when I've, you know, been hearing, Tolkien fans object to the fact that we get Legolas and Toriel in Lake Town in film two. It's, well, no, the elves do go to Lake Town. It's just what we're getting in the film is, you know, an advanced squad. And so the question is,
right,
what's going to be the relationship between that first trip to Lake Town and the second trip,
right,
to Lake Town? It could be a parallel, as I was suggesting with my rose-tinted view, or it could be, you know, an anti-parallel. You know,
right,
it could be setting up that kind of, you know, that kind of disappointment. So,
well, there's also a middle ground. Kim, kind of in her Kim, I hope you're a her. Comment makes me think too that maybe a less nefarious thing is simply, geez, you know, the dragon's dead. I wonder if the dwarves are still alive. Let's go make a exploratory just to find out what's going, you know, let's find out what's happening now,
right,
rather than, you know, I'm going to go get the treasure. I mean, it just, or I'm going to go help Lake Town. It may just simply be, let's go see what's going on.
Well, and
he's got all those armored elves that are just standing around. So
exactly. But don't forget the other factor involved here in the films, which was not at all involved in the book, is that the elves are in crisis. Thranduil seems pretty worried about the fact that Sauron,
right,
is
true,
coming back. How does that factor in to their plans? Also, keep in mind, the end of film two saw Azog leading an army of orcs out of Dol Guldur, which I can only assume has to be headed north towards the Lonely Mountain. I can't imagine that orc army that we saw isn't the orc army that we're going to meet at the Battle of Five Armies. Therefore, is it, you know, how is that going to factor in? Is Thranduil going to have any intelligence of that army? Because his moves, again, in the book, there's no question of invasion from the south. There's no question. They're not. The elves in the book are not in a state of crisis. I mean, there are spiders and they dislike them, but they seem to be in a pretty steady state with them. However, we're talking about enemy armies on the move, up in the general direction of your home base. I mean, an orc army setting off from Dol Guldur coming north could just as well be going to squash the elf kingdom as it could be going anywhere else. So, you know, to what extent is that going to factor in? That, to me, is a complexity that makes the elves' actions and their sort of movements difficult to predict.
That's true. That could be. It's hard to imagine that they wouldn't see this giant army marching out of Dol Guldur, which is right around the corner from where they live. Probably the Dol Guldur army will march right through the line of sight of pointing elves.
Yeah, you'd think.
There's no chance that they wouldn't know.
Yeah.
And yet, the Battle of Five Armies, as it's told in the book, the arrival of the goblin army is supposed to be like this huge, catastrophic surprise.
Right.
Or maybe
right.
just catastrophic surprise.
It's kind of both.
That you know, ends the infighting and unites the different armies. That's an interesting point. I wonder, because that would really change. If he sees the goblin army marching toward the Lonely Mountain, and then he sets out for the Lonely Mountain, that could potentially be a huge change in the course of events. In fact, I hadn't even thought about that until now. Now I'm really disturbed. How on earth is he going to beat that army to the Lonely Mountain?
Since Azog can cover like 300 miles an hour, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even with that, even setting aside that, just assuming both armies would travel at roughly the same speed and assuming they're heading in the same direction.
Well, he's closer to it. I mean, he's closer to the
Lonely
Mountain.
I guess that's
mountain.
True.
But,
you know, it occurs to me, actually, something that Tom wrote, it occurs to me that we may have a parallel Aragorn Helm's Deep moment with Legolas chasing Bolg.
Yes.
And he may see the army coming and then turn around and hotfoot it back to let his dad and everybody else know that the orcs are coming,
Yeah.
That could really change, but there would basically be no Siege of the Lonely Mountain. if they're heading there with the foreknowledge that there's a giant goblin army coming that probably will kill all of us if we don't unite and fight them, why on earth would they get there and say, all right, we're going to surround you and lay siege to you until you come out and bring us our treasure? And
well,
we
but Legolas may not show up with his Paul Revere warning until after they're already at Erebor and siege.
Oh, okay. So maybe, actually Thranduil has already set out and we didn't even know.
Yeah, right.
That's an interesting, I hadn't even thought about till now. Now I'm really
concerned. let's think about that in days, right? As Smaug gets killed, the next day the elves are in Lake Town. The next day after that, they're at Erebor, right?
So. It's true.
I mean, as if it takes a full day, but...
Oh, that's true. The evening they're in Erebor.
it took Azog, like, 3 hours to get from Beorn's house to Dol Guldur. I mean...
Well, and think about the dwarves getting to the Lonely Mountain from Lake Town. I mean, what was that? They left in the morning and got there, like, late afternoon.
Yeah, exactly. And they got from Beorn's house all the way across Mirkwood in about 36 hours at most.
That's right.
So, yeah, it's not a problem. But anyhow, one other thing, Dave, that I would throw into this, though. Mm-hmm. Don't forget that the orc army in Dol Guldur was invisible.
That's true.
It had been cloaked by the power of Sauron. And that seems... Of course, Gandalf was, like, busily mucking that up and revealing it. But that might also, perhaps, come into play for the... You catastrophic, sudden, unexpected appearance of an orc army at the Lonely Mountain, if that same kind of cloaking thing happens with them and they are. So it's possible that, you know, I love the image of Legolas as Paul Revere, by the way. I think that's just lovely. So if you know, he comes galloping up and says they're coming, but then they don't see them and they don't know where they are, and then they just
now,
suddenly appear. That would I don't know.
Crossfit moment. Are they using Romulan shields?
No. Clearly not. That's not possible. Yeah. So anyway,
Romulans don't share that kind of technology.
Yeah. Exactly. Please.
That's a really interesting point, though. I think because in the book, it's just basically just how are they alerted to the presence of the Goblin army? It seems like Gandalf sort of already knows or suspects.
Yeah, Gandalf does know, but he didn't think they would. They still beat him. You know, they still come more quickly than he. Although, is expected.
It's interesting that he doesn't choose to share that information
right.
until it's completely obvious at the right time. Guys, there's some goblin armies coming.
Right.
Oh, yeah, I was going to tell you that.
Right. I have something that I should have probably shared with you a little while back, actually, but I think I'll not
and
tell you.
It looks like you already know. So, there you go.
Right. Yep. No, it does seem to be what Gandalf is doing there. But he even in the published Hobbit, he seems to have a sort of a flair for the dramatic. You know, you think about the revelation of the map and key at Bag End, for instance, is sort of another similar moment of you know, Gandalf doing that kind of surprise reveal on everybody. Okay, do we have to get towards the riddle yet? We're actually doing better for time than I thought. Let's think a little bit more about the siege, though. Setting aside the perplexing goblin army question.
We started late, so I'd say another 50 minutes or something.
Yeah, no, I'm watching the time based on the true time of our recording, not the clock time.
Got it.
No, we're still okay for a little bit. So let's set aside for a second the question of the possibly invisible and possibly not... possibly Paul Revere warned and possibly not Goblin Army, and just think about the standoff, if we get something like the standoff, which I'll be frankly disappointed if we don't, because the potential for, you know, the interest of that sort of standoff, the Bard, Thranduil, and Thorin with their standoff at the gates of the mountain, each one of which, well, in the book, with the exception of Thranduil, But anyway, each one of which has really quite an understandable point of view, and you can kind of get behind each one of their perspectives. Even Thorin. Thorin goes over the top, but still, you can easily see his point. I mean, the question that he asks to Bard and the Elven King at first when they appear is really an excellent question. Who is this who comes armed as if for war to the gates of the King under the Mountain? You know, it's easy for Bard to say, we're not at war, Thorin, we are not yet foes. Yeah, well then why did you bring a freaking army to my gate? And why are you encamped defensively in front of my gate? You know, as if you are besieging me or something. You're not acting like a friend. Why should I assume you are? So, I think although Thorin clearly does lose it, yeah, that's a completely defensible question on his part. And I think his suspicion is quite warranted, especially given the understandable unfriendship with which he remembers his treatment at the hands of the Elven King. So anyway, that whole situation in the book is very interesting. The situation as they have complicated it in the film promises to have all kinds of wrinkles, which could work out in really interesting ways, because that triad of Thorin, Elven King, and Bard is complicated by Toriel and Legolas on Thranduil's side, by the Master and the Master's lackey. What's his name? The Master's lackey?
Gofred?
Gofred.
Alfred,
right? Yeah, the Grima guy. Anyway, so you've got the political complexities on the Lake Town side as well, and then you've got Keely prominently, but even Beaufort and Ori and who isn't there another one? Who was there in Lake Town?
Beaufort, Keely, Feely.
Oh, Feely, of course, stayed with him, right?
And Owen.
Right, and yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, that's right, it's Owen. I said Ori, I meant Owen. Yes. So, you've got basically, at least potentially, divisions and possibly something like intrigues in each of those three camps. And so, where are the major players going to fall out, and how are these other pieces going to fall? Are they going to be making deals with each other? And then, of course, into all of these policies come Bilbo and the Arkenstone.
And don't forget that there's been definitely in the conversation, did you say this? I mean, I was writing an answer to somebody, so I'm going to miss, I'm really dumb here. But in his conversation with Thorin, when he had captured him, he's still holding against the fact that they didn't give him his necklace.
Right, exactly. So he has his kind of stake in the question has been upped a little bit. Again, in the book, he's just kind of an opportunist and somebody who is involved in a genuinely humanitarian way with the people of Lake Town. So the only real excuse, the only defensible excuse for Thranduil to be at the Lonely Mountain at the end is, you know, he's looking out for the interests of his friend Bard of Lake Town. You know, he wants to see help brought to the men of the lake and justice done for Bard. And I'm sure he's all generous minded about that. But anyhow, so yes, with the gems and everything, we're already told the personal stake that he has. So notice, what they've done is prepared a line for Thranduil, which is parallel to the line that Bard had in the book. Remember, Bard comes to the gates of the Lonely Mountain and says, I have several claims here. One, I killed the dragon. Don't I deserve some of his treasure? Like, that's kind of how it works, right? So, give me some as the dragon slayer. But also, he says, some of the treasure you have there is mine. You know, Smaug pillaged Dale also. And that's not yours. You can't claim the treasure of Dale. The treasure of Dale belongs to Girion and his heirs, and that's me. So you are holding what is rightfully mine. Thorin wouldn't stand for that if the situation were reversed, no question. So Bard has a very legitimate claim. So now notice Thranduil now has a similar claim. You are holding something which is owed to me. Your grandfather owed it to me and stiffed me for it back then. But now I still want it. So again, he does have that kind of argument, that kind of position.
I think Thranduil's point of view, first of all, one of the things is I do expect that we'll see some kind of a character arc for Thranduil, where by the end of the movie he is more open, because then later he sends, you know, 2 years later he sends his son to the Council of Elrond. But I think at this stage of the movie and the siege, we are still going to see the aristocratic, I am above, you know, everybody else Thranduil.
Yes.
And so I think his viewpoint at the siege is really going to be very haughty and very, very dismissive of even the humans that he's quote unquote allied with. I mean, I think he's going to have a really troublesome point of view and position there.
Yep. Yeah. No, I agree with that. That is, to me, just simply how snooty they've made Thranduil in the second film is the thing that argues to me most against the purely humanitarian angle.
Yeah.
And especially, and especially add to that how ornery they've made Bard.
Yes.
Yes.
If Thranduil is snooty, Bard the character the bard they've given us it seems like the sort of guy that's not going to tolerate it.
Yes, yes. Yeah, no, I mean, I can see Bard and the Elven King were pretty much hand in glove in the book. There does not seem to be any division between them.
Right.
Like once the Elven King came to help and support Bard, you know, the two of them were perfect chums from there on out. I agree, Dave. I think we're going to see some tension between them in film three.
Very different. Yeah, you're right, because in the book he is humanitarian, and they do have actually quite a good, I mean, I think, don't they, from what I remember, is quite a good relationship with the Lake Town men.
It seems like it, yeah.
Yeah.
So, this all leads up to our riddle. We might as well bring in the riddle, because we're already kind of, it's what I want to move to talk about specifically next. Our riddle is... What stand will Legolas and Toriel take regarding the Siege of Erebor? Option A, and the main question is there going to be a divide? What is going to be the nature of a divide, if there is one, between Legolas and Toriel and Thranduil? How are the major elven players going to fall out in the Siege of Erebor? Option A, they will both defy Thranduil. Option B, Legolas will support his father and Toriel will defy him. Option C, Toriel will support Thranduil and Legolas will defy him. Or D, both will actively support Thranduil. How do we think the Elven camp, thinking, you know, hanging on to the rest of it, you know, we'll talk about Lake Town politics later, we'll talk about Bard's point of view, of course we'll talk about Thorin's point of view, all of those things are yet to come in future episodes. Thinking about just the Elven perspective on things, what do we expect to see in that period leading up to the Battle of Five Armies? You know, and to some extent I think we can sort of include the Lake Town period in this as well. Thinking about the interactions that Toriel and Legolas and Thranduil are going to have in film three. What do we think?
You know, by the way, I switched this around, you know, after we talked, and Stephen makes a good point, which is if we go for a book answer with two completely characters that have no part of the book at all, right. D would actually be A, I guess.
You're right. Actually, yeah, let's switch that. In fact, let's switch
Shall
that right
that?
Now. Yeah,
let's
switch
that
right now. Steve, that is well caught. This is, of course, one of those which doesn't exactly have a book answer, rigorously speaking. But
so while we talk, I'll switch that around.
Yeah, very good. So we'll say it again. Sharon has a clarifying question. At the beginning of the siege, sustained throughout, can they have a shift of position? We can kind of decide where we think it falls out later on. But, I mean... In that specifically, I'm thinking of the question of what they do. It's obvious at the end of film two, Smaug has left and the dwarves are still there in possession of the Lonely Mountain. So we're going, it seems quite inevitable that we're going to have the Thorin and the other dwarves walled up in the Lonely Mountain confronting the elves and the men of Lake Town. That conflict seems inescapable, and I certainly hope it's inescapable in film three. So the real question in the question of what to do about Thorin and the dwarves, in the question of what to do about the treasure, where are they going to be? Maybe they, you know, maybe they change, but I'd say, you know, we'll talk that over after the fact. Just the question is, are they going to, at the end of the day, are they going to toe the party line, Legolas and Toriel, or are they going to stand up to Thranduil? Are they going to actually defy him? So we're talking about open defiance, not just standing around with a grumpy face while he does what he does, and like Legolas rolling his eyes and giving disapproving looks to his father behind his back. We're talking about open defiance, you know, like Toriel, you know, going over and putting her arm around, you know, her little love bunny and saying, "I stand with the short people." Like, that's what we're talking about. Defiance of Thranduil. Opposition could be opposition. I mean, if Legolas has heated exchanges with Thranduil, publicly, and, you know, not just, you know, I would say if Thranduil and Legolas have a heart-to-heart in which Legolas says, "This is really the wrong thing to do," and Thranduil says, "Shut up, boy," and Legolas says, "I'm going to be really grumpy, but I'll shut up," he's not defying him. Counseling his father to do something else in private is different, but I'm talking take a stand against him in public. That's what I mean by defy.
Or what about doing something covertly to undermine him?
If say Toriel and or Legolas leaves and goes off to do like a Robin Hood thing against Thranduil and doesn't come back, I would call that defiance. Like, they're acting in defiance of Thranduil. But if Legolas like sneaks out by night and does something defiant, but then comes back and stands with his father, you know, in public, then I would not call that defiance. I would call that subversion, but I wouldn't call it defiance.
Okay, all right, fine.
Like, Legolas sneaking off and going to Lake Town against his father's orders, that wouldn't be defiance if we see him like sneaking in the back door before Thranduil is any the wiser. I wouldn't call that defiance.
Suppose I believe that. Hypothetical. Suppose that Thranduil takes the dwarves in Lake Town hostage, and then tries to use them in negotiation with Thorin, and Legolas and Toriel break them out late at night and help them escape. But then when they show up at the negotiations the next day, they're like, you know, they're sitting there going, "Rah, rah, go Thranduil." And he has no idea that they broke them up. I mean, probably that's unlikely. Probably if they do that, they will end up getting caught and they'll be brought before him and then they will turn to open defiance. But all right, well, actually, let's do that one first. Suppose they're brought before him and they're not arguing vociferously with him, but they're just, you know, but they're also not apologizing and saying, "You're right, I shouldn't have broken the dwarves out." Is that open defiance?
Yes. Yes, okay. That clearly is.
Suppose they succeed in subverting him without his knowledge. What would we call that?
It's difficult.
Let's add another three or four answers.
Yeah, really, yeah. I think that's really the best option. If we have, like, 10 different possibilities so that we have every potential scenario have its own different answer, I think that's really the best.
None of the above. I think that the answer to that gets answered when the right answer gets decided on it.
Yeah, I think we just sort of decide what the general sense of the film is. One change, Trish, that I would think we could do to make it seem a little clearer to people. Maybe we also, in addition to switching D to A, maybe let's rephrase D a little bit, so that it's not quite so binary. Have the now A answer be neither one of them openly defy Thranduil. Have it be a negative, rather. That is, if our only two options are they either actively support him or they openly defy him, there's a lot of middle ground that
yes.
becomes a pretty uncertain.
Let's turn all of the active support into into...
Don't openly defy. Yes.
Yeah, don't openly defy.
Yes. Yes. Either they openly defy him or not.
Yes.
I think that'll simplify things a little bit.
Yeah, that eliminates the confusion.
Oh, yeah, but
I actually think... I still think... I think we should add a fifth answer that is the true book answer, which is neither Legolas nor Toriel will appear in the film.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think we should obviously do that. Probably in the opening series of the film, they'll just like roll some text that will tell us that Toriel and Legolas were killed off screen and not to expect to see them in the film. I think that's probably the best move.
Yeah, Toriel was killed off screen and Legolas got pulled into some other business.
Right, he's not going to come back. He went riding off and will next be seen at the Council of Elrond. Thank you very much.
He actually set out for the Council.
Yes, he's just going on a roundabout trip. And since he has no bunny sled or warg to ride upon, he's going to take years to get there instead of moments. So they will openly defy or not openly defy Thranduil. By the way, a side question. Actually, I like Yana's idea that Yana just chases Bolg throughout the entire movie. Like, you know, every 10-15 minutes we switch back to a little scene of Lego still riding in pursuit, and then we just cut away from him, and then, you know, that's pretty much it. He's never going to do anything.
They could include like a little sort of comedic jingle whenever they come on screen.
Right, exactly. And we'll just see them
Dudley Do-Right song. Right?
Have either of you guys ever watched Family Guy?
No.
Been a while.
You know the running gag of him like of Peter fighting with the chicken, just like the extended fight scene that they have that lasts like 10 minutes, 15 minutes. Just keeps going, and they traverse through all kinds of different locales and settings. I think that's what we'll get.
Yeah, or you know, it could just be, you know, like, yeah, in as other scenes are happening, we'll just like in the distance, in the background, see Legolas and Bolg, you know, riding across in various contexts. Could very well happen. Okay, quick question. In connection with these things, do you think that Toriel and or Legolas will be in Lake Town when Smaug, will they be involved in the defense of Lake Town? Is it possible even that Toriel gets killed by in the destruction of Lake Town? That she doesn't even make it to the Battle of Five Armies?
Yeah, it's possible. And I think definitely she'll be there when the dragon comes. I mean, for sure.
She'd have to leave pretty darn quickly in order to miss it, looks like.
Yeah,
so what role is she going to play?
She might get killed, you know, saving Keeley.
Right, exactly.
That's kind of where we're leading up to, whether it's at Erebor or Lake Town.
Is it possible that she and Keeley both die? I mean, you know, we're all ready to kill off Feely and Keeley. I mean, you know, Tolkien fans are emotionally prepared for this.
Did Beaufort and Owen die? They didn't, did they, in the book?
Nope. No, in the book it's just Thorin and Feely and Keeley who die. Okay. Of course, in the Rankin Bass film, it's like 8 of them, but completely senselessly.
Right. And we know that Jackson actually has, you know, tipped his cap to the Rankin Bass film before.
Exactly. I'd have to watch it again. I don't remember offhand the list of, because they name them, the dwarves who are killed in the battle. I forget.
Oh, great! You get to watch it again. Yeah, you go ahead and do that and let us know. Get back to us on that.
All right. I'll try to report back. You know, watch the Rankin Bass again, like I do every week. You know, but anyway, so it's conceivable. Say Toriel and Keeley are both killed. You know, they're like having this touching hand holding moment. You know, like maybe the answer to like, you know, do you think that she could love him is like the building bursting into flame and the two of them dying a painful, horrible death. You know, that's conceivable. Let's face it, we're all expecting both of those characters to die in film 3 sooner or later. So maybe what we get is Feely returning alive with Keeley dead, and that this emotionally factors into Thorin's state, you know, during the final standoff and the final battle. I don't know. Personally, I don't find it very satisfying. I would expect a 100% survival rate of elves and dwarves in the attack on Lake Town.
Yeah. Well, especially given that the dragon can't kill him at Erebor. I mean...
Right. You know. Right. You had a far better chance there.
Yeah.
Just statistically,
I think we're going to have a touching battlefield moment with Keely and Tauriel.
Yeah,
I still think we're going to have more touching moments. So I'm betting they're going to end up at the battle.
Well, I mean, we've all been speculating for a while that you know, the immediate future destiny of Feely, Keely, Owen, and Beaufort, and presumably Tauriel as well, is going to be breaking Bard out of prison.
Right.
Because somebody's got to get Bard out of jail so he can and expediently so that he can get up and shoot the dragon. So, you know, there's that. What role they actually could play, if any, in the actual fight against the dragon, I don't even know how that's going to happen. I mean, we'll talk about this later. We'll talk about Smaug at Lake Town in more detail later on.
Yeah.
But it's hard for me to imagine Legolas there, though, because, again, he was last seen, you know, all jokes aside, he was last seen riding quickly in the opposite direction as Smaug is flying towards Lake Town. I can't imagine he's involved. But now, again, Legolas is going to hear about this, right? You know, this might interfere with Legolas's Paul Revering if he hears that, like, the dragon attacked Lake Town,
yeah,
like, minutes after he left, and that Tauriel was there. This is presumably...
Here's a really obscure literary... parallel, like the Highwaymen.
You are all over the cross references today.
Am I showing off now?
Yes.
But Corey knows what I am.
Yeah,
about.
Yeah. You know, hey, you know, that could be actually maybe Legolas goes, meets up with some of the other elves and brings them to Lake Town. You know, to like, because he knows Toriel's there and he's going to go back. And so Thranduil's going to accompany him in arms. If he's going to insist on going back into the war zone, I don't know. But, so Legolas is probably not going to be involved. I suspect Toriel's not going to die. But if we're right about this, if we're right about Tauriel and Keely and Feely and Owen and Beaufort's role being to break Bard out of prison and presumably help him to get up to the windless, what are we calling it?
Ballista?
Well, we're not calling it a ballista. What's the
windless
word? Windless? Yeah, windless. They did call it a windless, right.
Did they call it a windless?
Yeah, to get up to the windless, which is... Correct.
Which is weird for me because being a sailor, a windlass is what I use to pull my anchor out of the water. So
right, you know. Which is very similar. It's the crank mechanism thing. That's
yeah,
not
it's
the
crank.
Whole.
It's yeah.
the, that's
yeah.
why the windlass was associated with crossbows, especially large ones. But anyway, yeah. So so if he's going to get up to the windlass and shoot the dragon, they're going to be his allies. They're going to be fighting with him and
right.
on his behalf. I mean, I presume that we're going to get not only them. Breaking him out of prison, but probably, you know, fighting a rearguard action while he, you know, like defending the base of the tower while he goes up and shoots the dragon. This is what I'm picturing anyway, going on. What happens after that? So then if they escape and Bard escapes, there they are, you know, the allies who have just fought together, you know, so there's like Bard, Tauriel, Feely, and Keely high-fiving each other on the shores of the lake. With the dragon dead, and then they go from there to the Siege of the Lonely Mountain?
Well, you know, we could do a similar riddle with regard to how the dwarves, behave toward Thorin.
Exactly.
Because, yeah, it seems to me like the only logical thing is they're going to be accompanying the men and the elves to the mountain.
Yeah, or at the very least, even if they're not there with them physically, you know, they're going to have, I mean, you know, the relationship between Feely and Keely and Bard, as between Tauriel and Bard, is presumably going to be significantly influenced by this, even if they do leave and join up with Thorin afterwards.
Well, here's another one. Thranduil, who doesn't have any warm feelings for the dwarves, may take them as hostages and use them
right.
when he gets to Erebor. I think I've mentioned
yep.
that before.
Yep, the Feely and Keely as hostages plan is certainly something that's been on the table for a while. It's one queer use that they could be put to, being all conveniently there in Lake Town and all. And that would certainly fit more in with the
Sharon's come up with a good idea. Tauriel doesn't die in the Battle 5 armies.
As a jerk, not a humanitarian view of things.
Sharon says that Tauriel doesn't die in the Battle 5 armies, and she goes on a journey to return Keeley's rune rock to his mother.
So are you guys any closer to answers to the riddle?
No.
Can you hear me?
Oh, sorry, I can hear you now.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, Sharon Hoff was saying Tauriel doesn't die in Battle 5 armies. She goes on a journey to return Keeley's rune rock to his mother, takes up with another dwarf, and is never heard from again. And I'm bringing that up to stall because I have no idea what my answer is. I help create these riddles. I should create riddles that I can answer. I mean, jeez.
Yeah. Hey, you know, maybe Keeley and Tauriel just like retire. You know, Keeley abdicates, and the two of them go off and live happily ever after somewhere. Could totally happen.
Okay, I'm going to step out here, and I'm going to go with D.
Okay.
And the reason I'm going to go with D is, first of all, Tauriel's kind of been working on Legolas, right? So she's been sort of changing his mind. The other thing is we do eventually need to get to a place where Thranduil is, in fact, in charity toward, you know, other people besides his people. So I think his son openly defying him, and Tauriel, of course, too, will be a big thing for him, and it'll cause that may be what triggers his character arc.
Right, now here's another curveball, though.
Oh shoot! Okay, I'm not in stone yet. So
how consistent do we suspect Peter Jackson is going to try to be between Legolas at the end of the third film and Legolas at the beginning of the Council of Elrond? Because we remember how, like, anti-dwarf he was.
Oh, yeah, he was anti-dwarf.
So
he?
Do we have him... That's so right. So here's another possibility. Legolas comes back, you know, whether or not he's Paul Revering, he comes back to find Tauriel and see if she's safe, and finds that she's not only safe, she's shacked up with this dwarf. And so he, like, gets all mad and basically goes over to his dad's side. And she is defiant against Thranduil, and he's all like,
I hate dwarves again.
I hate dwarves again, and I think, like, my only complaint with my father's policy is that he is insufficiently intolerant of dwarves for my tastes now.
And especially if Tauriel ends up getting killed because she's defending Keeley or, you know, because she's fighting to save a dwarf of some sort. I mean, that
yeah, exactly. I mean, it's possible to do this in a way that makes of course, one of the difficult pressures is it's going to be hard to carry this story off in a way that makes Legolas look awful. I mean, you know, for him just to look like a complete jerk is hard to imagine pulling that off. But,
well, I think the one way they could explain his hatred of dwarves without making him look like a complete jerk is his heartbreak over her death.
Right. Right.
You know, I mean, I agree. And then when we see Fellowship of the Ring, then we kind of have that backstory. It's so funny. This is kind of going the same way that you talk about Unfinished Tales going, isn't it?
Right.
It's like the same kind of chronology of writing the stuff.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. Okay, so I'm stepping back for a moment, and I'm going to mull.
We're just about out of time. Dave, what do you think?
Uh-oh. Well, he's playing with us. He's not giving us.
I think it's virtually guaranteed that Tauriel is going to openly defy him at some point.
Yeah, I think C, with Legolas defying Thranduil and Tauriel not defying him, seems to me the most unlikely. It's hard to imagine that happening.
Yeah, I think it's got to be B or D. I'm going with D.
Okay, both of them.
I think by the time we reach that point, I think the character arc... So Tauriel seems virtually guaranteed to defy him, and there's going to be so many opportunities along the way. And I think that the character arc that we see Legolas on, he's already disobeyed Thranduil's order to lock the doors and stay within the bounds, unless there's an off-screen scene that we haven't seen where he goes and tells Thranduil, by the way, Toriel left. Despite the fact that you closed our borders, Toriel left, and Thranduil says, all right, well, go get her.
Right. No, I can't. Which, I don't think he would do that. Yeah.
Yeah, which doesn't seem likely. So I feel like the character arc he's on, he's already kind of disobeyed Thranduil. So I think by the time we reach the siege, that point in the film, which is going to be probably a third to a halfway through this film, I imagine the Smaug attack is going to be a nice lengthy one.
Right.
I think by that time, his character arc is going to have led him into at least, if not vociferous, certainly sort of consistent defiance or disobedience of Thranduil. Maybe he won't argue with him in front of everyone, but when brought before Thranduil to account for some attempt at subversive action, he will be unapologetic.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. I'm going with D.
Okay.
You want me to step forward, or are you going to go?
No, you go ahead.
Oh, no, that's okay. You go ahead.
Well,
you have given me pause to consider, and I could. This is my problem. I always get way too cerebral about this stuff when thinking about what Jackson's going to do. You know, the thing is, I want to believe that he's going to remain. You know, it's going to be believable again when we see the Fellowship of the Ring after we see this movie. That
yeah.
Legolas has the reaction that he does. I just have my, if nothing else, I have faith in Philippa that she would say, you know, we really need to do this. So I'm thinking that though he toys with, you know, he listens to Tauriel and he toys with the idea that maybe she's right and maybe his father could be wrong. When the chips are down and it's time to do battle or it's time to, you know, basically kind of go to war, he sides with his father. So I'm going to go with B.
Okay. I am strongly tempted by B, but I think I'm going to go with D also. I think that he's going to end up, I think there's going to be tension there. I think that we are going to end up with like a sad and embittered Legolas at the end, but I think that that can be done in the context of his, Dave, at the end of the day, I was thinking the same thing as you. The character arc of Legolas seems to be towards like that conversation, which was covered so heavily in the trailers of the Desolation of Smaug. You know, the whole "this is our fight" conversation seems to be like a turning point for Legolas when he was coming in entrenched in his father's policies, and she is changing his mind, and the trip into Lake Town seems to have solidified the changing of his mind, and whatever he goes on to discover in pursuit of Bolg is likely to continue that. So I would suspect that he's going to end up essentially on Toriel's side, which is going to be against Thranduil, but that still, he's still going to end up after her death, which I do suspect is probably going to come later in the film, rather than earlier. I think he's going to end up.
Do you think he'll reverse himself and go back to hating dwarves?
Not reverse himself. I don't think he has to support his father in order to end up hating dwarves. You know, because the issue is not that simple. You know, the issue is
right.
Especially since in pursuit of Bolg, what he's going to be coming up against is like the big, huge, you know, the big, huge tertium quid in the film Hobbit story. That is the necromancer and the evil encroaching on the world. You know, he can support Toriel in saying, we need to take action here. We need to have a different, we need to not just be snooty and isolationists. And thus be defying his father without having to be all warm and cuddly about dwarves. So, can I say, come on, commit, people. This is the only 34% of people have voted. Vote.
If people haven't paid attention, the poll is up. So
yeah, the poll is up.
Away from your screen, come over here and vote.
Yeah, vote on it. It's this is not binding. We're not gonna you know take. I don't even know if we can. I don't even think we have the data of who's voted for what. So you're not committed here. This is just for fun. You know, you'll be submitting your official vote later on.
Where are you today? Where are you today?
What do you think?
As I told Pete, we all, including the hosts, have the option of changing our answers before the final submission.
That's right. And I said, no one will even know what it is that you said here. So,
that's
okay,
right.
Good. All right, we're up to 66%.
Yeah, we're getting there now.
Good. Okay, and are we still...
I do feel happy that my horse is winning so far.
Your horse is winning. We have a majority of people supporting B so far.
I don't think that's because I'm particularly silver tongued, but
0% on C, which is not surprising.
Yeah, 0% on C.
That's really
we've got some really outside the box thinkers with A, 6%. That's awesome.
Yeah, neither openly defies. You know, actually, I certainly agree. I'm very willing to agree with the percentages here that that's the third most likely option. You know, because I could see Toriel basically being a covert agent and not openly defying him. It's hard for me to imagine Toriel being like, I've decided upon like mature consideration that I am 100% behind everything that Thranduil says and thinks. Like, that's a little hard for me to imagine, but to say that she's going to be a purely covert agent and never openly defy him, that seems possible.
82% voted. I just am amazed we don't get 100%. It's really amazing. But I do want to close so I can show people the results. Do we want to close yet?
Sure.
Okay. And if I put money on this, I would be a millionaire. Oh, sure.
There we are. Okay.
So it's kind of a 1/3, 2/3 split almost with the
pretty close.
A few. The rebellious minority and, you know, bravo for the rebellious minority.
Yep. Cool. Excellent. Well, that's good. So our next episode... Wait, what is our next episode going to be? I've forgotten what our next episode is.
Hold on. I will let you know as you come up with some filler to discuss while
well, in the
this.
Meantime, let me say we spent a while, an unexpected to me amount of time at the beginning talking about the Unfinished Tales class. So I should mention that in our Unfinished Tales class, we are doing the Hunt for the Ring and the Battle at the Fords of Isen next week. So we're doing...
fantastic chapters of that book.
Oh, and he did Quest of Erebor. Anybody hasn't listened to Quest of Erebor, yeah, he did on Tuesday. It was awesome.
That was really fun. Yeah, I've been waiting to do... Because of years of doing Riddles in the Dark now, I've been like waiting for the Quest of Erebor chapter for
like
a long time.
For it.
Oh, man, yeah.
The Hunt for the Ring chapter is like one of my favorite things.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, you know, to be honest with you, there's so many things in the Unfinished Tales that at least upon my first read of it, on my discovery on it, I guess it's not really my favorite stuff that he's written because the reason I like it so much is that I love the other things that Tolkien's wrote.
Right.
And it sort of mentally, psychologically prepared me for it. But just the amount of joy that you get from reading some of these various chapters of the Unfinished Tales that either fill in some gaps of things that you were wondering about. Like the first time that you read The Hunt for the Ring, you're like, oh, that's really cool. I hadn't even thought about that. The Nazgul interacting with Saruman and stuff, and you're like, oh, that's really... I always wondered what was going on here, and here it is.
Yeah.
Or things that they give you a completely different perspective on a story you've already read, like the chapter on Tuor is just such a delightfully different presentation of not just that story, but just of, like, the power dynamics between the Valar and stuff. And then the Aldarion and Arrendis chapter is just, like, it's just completely different.
Yes.
You know, actually, Corey, as I was listening to that the second or third time through, or whenever I listened to it again, I was thinking that chapter completely jibes with my idea for a HBO Game of Thrones style
Numenor series. Yeah.
Yeah, I reading that chapter, I was like, I just ate up. I was like, aha, see, it would work really well.
So you got the relationship drama and everything.
Yeah,
it's all set.
Yeah. And also it opens the door to a more complex, like slightly more complex picture of morality and good and evil than people ascribe to Tolkien.
Yep.
Totally unfairly, of course.
But no, you're right. Exactly. No, it's very interesting that way.
But the thing is with because Silmarillion's filled with lots of really bad good guys, and there aren't any really good bad guys. But Lord of the Rings, we get a picture where we get a crisis moment, right? Where, like, it's pretty clear what needs to be done. We got to fight Sauron. There's just no hope. There's no time to sit and dither about, is it morally justified to go to war, and what do we have? And it's like, no, he's on the doorstep. It's too late. We got to fight. So things become a little more black and white, a little more clear. But the story that we get in Aldarion and Arrendis is a lot more, it's kind of like, it's a little more complicated because the real threat is so far off.
Yes.
And also because we know where this ends up leading.
Right. Exactly.
We know very well that in the moment it seems like the right thing to do to prepare to fight, and yet we know that his foreboding is correct.
Yes.
It's going to end up that they are going to turn into the very thing they're trying to fight.
Exactly. Exactly. And exactly. And it's you can see Tolkien really, I find it fascinating the way that he works. So, I mean, one impulse could be for him to be, as he goes back to these stories later on, to be kind of glamorizing them more. I mean, Numenor has such a glamour about it, from the Lord of the Rings point of view. Thinking of, the way that Faramir talks about it, and it would be easy to go back and be like, I'm going to tell a tale of Numenor, and it's going to be like the glory and the wonder of Numenor. And instead we get like the incredibly complex moral ambiguity of Numenor. And that's, it's kind of an unexpected, it's a really rich and unexpected thing. And it's really cool. So anyway, so we're going to be finishing the Third Age this coming week. Though if you have been following along with the classes, I would remind people we have a change in schedule next week. Normally they're on Tuesdays. This week it's going to be next Friday. So it's going to be next Friday night, the 28th, at 9:30 p.m. Eastern time instead of the Tuesday. Because I'm going to be on the road, but we'll still have class, just on a different day. So yes, the Hunt for the Ring and the Battle of the Fords of Isen. Be prepared to talk about Gandalf and Saruman. I'm so excited to talk about Gandalf and Saruman from the Hunt for the Ring. So that's my one announcement. And then next week, as I think I'm remembering now, Trish, we're talking about the beginning of the film, right?
Yes, we're going to start our chronological working through the story, so we're starting about at the beginning with the beginning of the film.
Okay, yeah. So we'll be talking about the film's opening next week, the beginning of the consideration of the sort of the plot arc, the internal plot arc of film 3, for next time. So that's what we have coming up.
Another fabulous day. Thanks everybody for coming. It was really fun.
Yeah. Thanks to everybody who joined in here today, and thanks you guys for joining me. And as always, I will say thank you for listening, and Godspeed.